Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am joined, as always, by the amazing JP. Hey, JP.
Yo, how's it going?
It is going really well. A lot of code shipping this week, which is exciting. You know, just red-green refactor and pushing merging PRs and doing all the other things, the life of a developer. It's been busy, busy. How about you?
Nice. Yes. So this week in open listings, I am assigned as the test engineer of the week. So every week we have two different like assignments. It's like a rotating thing. So at any given week, we have one person who's assigned to be a QA engineer. Test engineer, I guess sort of the same thing. And another engineer who's assigned to be the like on-call person. So the on-call person mostly just responds to people who are on support or anyone else in the company who might be having like issues, anything ranging from like as someone who's on customer support might say like, oh, hey, a user is complaining that they can't log in or something like that, all the way to someone from marketing saying like, hey, I'm not sure how this feature works. So that's basically what an on-call engineer does.
Interesting.
On the other hand, a test engineer, which I am this week, is basically just making sure that our master branch is always green. So we have like, you know, a handful of flaky tests. Freaking Capybara will do that to you. But the goal is to make sure that master is always green. And when you can, try to fix those flaky tests. If master is, for whatever reason, red and it's not because of a flaky test, then what we do is we track down like the commit or the branch that was merged in and then poke the person who is responsible for that commit and say like, hey, make sure you fix this so we can keep master green. So that's kind of cool.
Wow. So is this role on top of your normal job or is this just your job right now?
Yeah, no. So this is like part of the sprint. So we point these as part of our like 8-point capacity. Like if you're test engineer 1 week or if you're on call, then that gets taken into account with like what you're assigned for the sprint.
Interesting. So you will get less normal development assignments when you have this role.
Yes. Although I think it wasn't accounted for this sprint for me. I didn't know I was going to be test engineer, but it's fine. I'm like also working on this really fully featured thing where I'm like touching every part of our app.
Wow. You've got a lot going on right now. Craziness.
Yeah, I'm back in like JavaScript React land after being in Ruby land for so long. And, you know, Ruby.
It's painful, isn't it? To be laying in the soft grasses of Ruby and come over to the thorny patches of React is not pleasant.
Yeah.
It's just very thistly.
It's just, they're just like different problems to solve, like, you know, front end UI problems.
And absolutely. Yeah. Totally different brain space in general. Cool. Well, thanks for the updates.
Yeah.
I want to jump into this final chapter. I'm super excited that is part 2 of chapter 8, which marks the absolute end of Pragmatic Programmer. Kind of sad, kind of bittersweet to watch this book close out, but we've got a lot of great tips to cover today. So I'm going to go ahead and blow through them and kind of read them off, and we can kind of start going through them one by one. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right. So the first tip for today is tip 65, test state coverage, not code coverage. Tip 66, find bugs once. 67, English is just a programming language. 68, build documentation in, don't bolt it on. 69, gently exceed your users' expectations. And tip 70, the final tip, sign your work. So first tip of the day is test state coverage, not code coverage. And I have so dealt with the pain of this tip, and I think it's a really good tip. So let's start to break this one down. What do you say, JP?
Yeah, let's do it.
So a quote from the book here is, quote, identify and test significant program states. Just testing lines of code isn't enough, unquote. And, you know, it talks about these coverage tools that'll kind of run all your code and monitor how much of your code is covered, like SimpleCov. There's tons of these things. And they're super nice, and they're a good starting benchmark for code coverage. But it's really important to remember, they only give you a window of whether it's failing or passing in that state that you're setting up the test to pass. And it gave an example of actually, if you had a single test with a different integer value that accepted any valid integer, then instantly that test has 10,000 different states to instantly test, or more if you think about how high or low an integer could go. And so if your method or function is dependent on its input, then technically you should be testing 10,000 states in that specific example. Now that's an extreme example, pushing to the extreme, but you know, thinking about this type of thing, the test state coverage, not code coverage, really comes back to a lot of the other tips that we've talked about, which is making sure you're decoupled from time, decoupled from a specific state, and to be thinking about all the different states that an object can be in and test those independently. And one of the biggest things to me is if you can extract a state out into a separate object or method or function, it's best to do that so you can test it decoupled from its other states and kind of test that specific state of an object into of itself. You know, instead of just testing your tutoring sessions object and that's it, test the confirmed tutoring session object as its own type of object. So that's kind of my soapbox about state coverage. What have you got, JP?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like you mentioned, if you have an integer, there's like so many different permutations. In fact, like infinitely many. And I know like some tools will have, like they'll tell you your coverage based on state too. So like, let's say you have an if else nested in another if else, it will take that into consideration. Like did your tests actually hit that deeply nested branch? But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're testing all of the different states or permutations that are possible. So I think that's just something to like definitely keep in mind. It's interesting because in like the Ruby and Hollywood Slack channel, someone had recently like posed this question of like, what's your guys's opinion on obtaining 100% code coverage or like test coverage? And to me personally, I think fixating on this idea of 100% test coverage is like actually just like not productive. In fact, I think it's like the opposite of pragmatic. I think as long as you have like good test coverage and you're like testing more than just, oh, I just tested the happy path, and you're actually taking into consideration some edge cases, the opposite of the happy path, if you're not just testing the positives, but also like the negatives,
yeah,
then I think it's fine. You know, like you should have a pragmatic approach towards testing and not, you know, chasing this like 100% code coverage, even though that's what the tip is saying is like test state coverage, not code coverage.
Yeah, interesting. Would you assign a recommended value, like a percent of coverage? Would you be so bold?
Yeah, I think in my head, a good number to get is like 70-75% test coverage.
Yeah, I would probably live somewhere there. I mean, one of my active projects right now is at 86%, and it's a very nice place to be. But over the weekend, one of the admins was kind of in a screen that's not very often touched that didn't have any code coverage, and it was just totally broken. And it was difficult because I didn't have that test coverage, and I went ahead and I just like, it was over the weekend, it was late on a Sunday. I didn't write test coverage first. I just kind of wrote a patch. I thought I knew what was wrong. But when I wrote that patch, I actually introduced more bugs into the same screen. It was actually in a worse state when I tried to fix it. And that actually leads us perfectly into tip 66, which is find bugs once. And the idea is that once a human tester finds a bug, it should be the last time ever that a human tester finds that bug. Automatic test should test it from then on. And what I should have done when this error was reported in this area that didn't have test code coverage is I should have written the test, had it fail, and refactored until it was green. And then I would have been a lot more confident in the deploy. And I broke this pattern this weekend, even though I've already learned this lesson. Hey, I'm human, okay? And I ended up making it worse off than it was before. So I'm trying to make two points. My first point is that even with 86% coverage, you can have real downtime that affects a business, and it's really painful. But I guess technically with 100%, you could still have some downtime and it's painful. And then the second one is kind of just a movement into our next tip, which is the idea of finding bugs once.
Yeah, there was this really good quote that stood out to me that was, you know, speaking for engineers, we have to spend our time writing new code and new bugs. So I think it's interesting how like finding bugs once is like that should be the last time you find that bug, because we need to spend more time solving actual business problems and creating more bugs and writing, you know, and shipping more features, which is sort of like our mantra at Open Listings is just like, you know, ship code, ship features, keep breaking things, keep building things. I like it. I'm into it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. As far as going back to state coverage versus code coverage, would you have any general tips for trying to approach and think about state coverage when writing tests or writing code versus just code coverage?
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of like state coverage, like let's say, for example, if I'm touching part of our mailer system that has to mail out a notification if a property has sold, or not that a property is sold, that a property's state has changed. So a property can be in many different states. It could be in contract, it could be in escrow, it could be sold, it could be off market, it can be You know, there's just so many different states for that. And then there's like also so many different people who could get emails sent to them based on those states. So like, let's say I favorited this property, I'm probably going to want to know when that property is, if it's no longer for sale, because like, you know, I'm keeping an eye on it, for example. So obviously there's a lot of logic that has to go into deciding whether or not an email gets sent. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that you have to like literally consider every single possible state that the email can be sent in and actually test that, because like you don't want to make assumptions that the email got sent to someone who favorited the property when it was off the market and then like assume that it's just going to work in the in a different
state.
In the other cases, because like, you know, sometimes it could feel like you're just like copying and pasting your tests, but like, you know, sometimes you actually have to test those different states and the tests can be repetitive, and that's why you have to make, you know, little reasonable methods that make it less repetitive. So obviously it's going to be, you know, repetitive to a certain extent, but there are obviously things you can do to make it more robust and less fragile so that you don't have to like, so that one change to a method makes it so that you have to change every single other method.
Totally. And I think that just goes back to the ideas of breaking objects down into smaller objects and decoupling methods, because, you know, where the state gets really insane is if one function or method depends on the state of another function or method, and then they're interdependent. And so then you know, if you have three states in one and four in the other, then all of a sudden you have 12 different states that need to be tested against. Where if you were to be able to, depending on the business case, decouple those methods from each other, if they weren't interdependent, then it's a lot easier to kind of test those things independently, is what I've found. And I think more and more just breaking things down into smaller and smaller objects that are just a lot easier to test and dumber things make it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Cool. So we've kind of gotten off track from our different tips here.
Yeah. I will say one thing though, that if I can get one last word in on testing, is that like,
yeah, let's do it.
One thing that I've made a better effort of doing, or not made a better effort because I try to do this every time, is like test the negative outcome as well. So like you're not just testing that an email got sent, but you also want to test to make sure that emails don't get sent too. So like in what scenarios do we actually not want emails to send is like something that you should also be testing for. So you have to like look at it from like a positive and also from like a negative, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I think especially in the case where you're pinging users, sending notifications, sending emails, charging cards, like you want to make sure that you're not processing a charge that for someone you shouldn't.
Right.
And it's really easy to do those types of things. I've done it in the past where, you know, it was charging one party when it should be charging the other, or lots of different mistakes like that. I've made them all. And you're totally right that if something is mission critical, if you're going to be bugging users when you shouldn't, or sending personal information to someone who shouldn't, like in the example of access is a really good one from a security standpoint, like make sure on screens where someone shouldn't see it, that you're testing that authentication across those screens. So basically every single one of your tests, at least like the integration tests or functional tests, should have the idea of, if I'm not logged in, I can't do any of this.
Right.
Which is easy to forget that you should be doing that. But there's tons of negative states we should be testing about. But I think especially when it comes to personal data, when it comes to sending emails, and then ultimately processing payments, it's really important that you're not doing it when you should, that you're not doing it by side effect. And, you know, from a systems design, there's ways to prevent that. But at the end of the day, like that 12-line test, I should say, could prevent, you know, thousands of dollars of potential equity lost in people's confidence in your business because you're mischarging cards when you shouldn't.
Yeah.
Those types of things are really, really important. So I think that's a really good tip, JP.
Yeah. And it's amazing how like the logic for actually just charging a customer might be a 4-line method, but then the test that you write for it to actually test all those different states, that could be like, you know, a couple hundred lines of code just to make sure that you're not charging them when you should be, you are charging them when you should be, you're charging them the right amount, you know, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when it comes to things like promo codes and credits and refunds and failed charges. I mean, payments in itself is this whole behemoth that is really difficult to test and think through those edge cases. And I think in general, when I'm stepping around really sensitive personal information, or I'm stepping around payments, even emails, I try to be really, really careful and test a lot more robust than something else that just might be a simple CRUD action that like isn't necessarily as mission critical. So I think that idea of state coverage, code coverage in general, really bleeds into, you know, how mission critical is this that it stays up? How mission critical is it that this doesn't or does happen? And those are the things that you kind of weight your decision of how high of code coverage you get to. Because I think for some businesses, 60% code coverage might be fine if it's really focused on what's mission critical and you have a lot of ancillary things that it's like, you know, it doesn't really affect the core of the business. Okay, that's up to you and what you're building. And I think in some instances, if you're in the medical space or you're in the finance space, you probably need to maintain 100% test coverage. And that's probably got to slow you down. You might have to move a little bit slower. So that's just, you know, you need to weigh that out for yourself and your own responsibility and your own organization. And sometimes this isn't your decision as the developer, unfortunately.
Yeah. Speaking of which, little fun fact before I let you hop into tip 67. I heard a little tidbit about something. I think it was NASA is the company that I heard this about, that they only write like 10 lines of code. Like if as an engineer at NASA, you only write 10 lines of code per day or something like that, because things are just that mission critical. I thought that was a pretty interesting little tidbit. 10 lines, you know?
Yeah, I could imagine that's true. It's literally people's lives, if not lives, then billions of dollars. I mean, I remember they just straight up lost a satellite. Do you remember when that happened? It was like a $12 billion satellite that was supposed to get imagery of Saturn. And there was all these conspiracy theories like, oh, they never built it. And that's why they quote unquote lost it. They were just trying to funnel money out of the government. I don't know. But also say is, I think you're totally right that if you are doing something that mission critical, if you're doing self-driving cars, I hope you're writing like 100 lines of code a day. I hope you're not writing too much code. Like you can't break things and ship fast when you're writing self-driving cars, as we've kind of seen with Uber. Anyway, on that, we should probably move into the next tip. So tip 67, English is just a programming language. This is the quote from the book. Write docs as you would write code. Honor the dry principle. Use metadata, MVC, auto-generation, and so on, unquote. And at the end of the day, they're trying to push you toward having a really high standard against everything we produce as developers, including English. And I really like the idea of treating it as a programming language and doing those same types of things of version control and, you know, not repeating yourself and being concise and eloquent is all really, really great. And I think it's good advice. I like it in theory, but I'm really having a lot of trouble. Well, I'm like really trying to follow this because there's other tips in the book that was like, you know, your code should be automatic. It's your documentation should be automatic. There was a lot of this stuff. And I have been really struggling, at least in my world of Rails, to have auto-generated docs, you know, user-facing docs, external API docs, internal docs, generated in a way that's elegant, that isn't just so time consuming and fiddly. And I've really been working hard at trying to do this and move in this direction because I love it in principle, but I've been really struggling to implement this in my day to day.
Yeah, totally. And there's like so many different kinds of documentation too, because there's like a README, right? Which is like, you know, instructions for if you're just hopping into a code base. And there's also like in code documentation. Yeah, you're right. Like in theory, it's cool to like treat your docs as if it's like part of your code because it is code, right? Treat English like a programming language. Yeah. But I struggle with this too. I know you're talking from like the context of like Rails land. Do you use like, have you heard of YardDoc at all? Because that's what we use for our Ruby stuff.
Yeah, I started like playing with it and I was like 2 hours into like all these configs and I just, it's really fiddly. All this stuff is super, super fiddly. And I think it's intended for teams and code bases that are much larger where someone can really own this as its own project. And I think that I'm a little bit of a unique species and that I have real applications at the scale I do, but I'm kind of a one plus man team. But, you know, I do work with other developers. And so I do need solid docs. And even just if I died tomorrow, there needs to be documentation on this stuff, even for myself. Because, you know, documentation too, it's just a really good point, is it's not just for everyone else on the project. It's for you 6 months from now.
Yeah.
Because you're not the same person. And you need to treat it like there's other people, even if you are the only developer. And, you know, I am the primary developer on these applications, but I do have a lot of help and I do have a lot of part-time contractors. And I'm really trying to push to really have a high standard for well-documented code. But yeah, to answer your question more directly, I've played with YardDoc. I've played with like 8 of the other kind of gem generator. I even was playing with one of the services. Everything feels very, very heavy-handed from what I've been trying to do. I haven't found something that isn't so time-restrictive that it makes sense to me. And I feel like the direction that stuff is going is odd, like putting it right in with your methods. I almost feel like docs should be generated from my tests. It's kind of what makes sense to my brain.
Yeah, this is like one of those things that I have like mixed feelings about. It's okay. So to your point about tests, I think tests serve as like documentation themselves. So like if you want right. if you want to understand how something works, look at the test, and the test should tell you mostly everything. But I will say that because Ruby is not a typed language and it's dynamic, when you create a method and you send in parameters, like who knows what those arguments are? Even if they're like named parameters, like the values of those could be strings, they could be integers, it could be like a method, it could be, you know, it could be whatever. And you have like no idea, it could be a hash, who knows? So it's cool to have like documentation like right above the method. Even if it's not explaining what it's doing, even if it's just telling you like, these are what the parameters are, you know, arg1 is a string, pass this in so such and such, it does this, you know, arg2 is an integer, blah, 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 blah. So that's kind of nice. I will say that it's helped me when I've come across like a method that I had no idea what the fuck it's doing. And then I just read the docs and I'm like, oh, okay, this is how I use it. Although I will say in instances where I do come across things like that, I just like look at the tests anyway, and the tests give me like a pretty good indication of what I need to be sending in. So it's sort of like this, you know, how much time do you want to spend like digging through? But I think that if you're using like a typed language where you have to specify like your argument is an integer, your argument is a blah, 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 maybe there's like less need for, you know, code comments and documentation. I can see why it's useful for something like Ruby or JavaScript. But I still have opinions on when you should use those. I feel like most of the time you shouldn't be using those. Like I think your functions and your methods should be small enough that like it's very obvious what it's doing. Because there are cases where it's like, oh, this method's kind of weird. Like I can't avoid it being this weird. So here's like three lines of commented out code explaining what it does and saying what the parameters are. I don't know. I don't think that your code should be like too documented.
Yeah, but I think in theory, this tip totally holds up that if you're going to have documentation, keep it dry, try to make it as automated as possible and make sure it doesn't get out of sync. However, you can do that. And that's really the heart of what this tip is. And I totally try to honor those things. I just really wish there was a magic bullet to do some documentation generation that made sense. I mean, I could imagine a world where something like a capybara test that's literally like login is this, click on this, then this should happen. I could imagine that being like a help guide. Like if you just were to extract that into plain English, it's like, here's how you update a profile photo because you're writing that anyway. I don't know. And I feel like I have a lot of thoughts on this. It's something I've thought about a lot because I feel like nothing has solved this really well. But I also think everyone's needs are so specific and everybody writes tests and methods in different ways that it's really hard to do an autogen that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah, you just have to write clean code because, okay, to the point of like capybara, while capybara tests do really explain like what a particular feature is doing, we have these things called sprint retrospectives. So like at the end of a sprint, we sort of give our feedback on things. And the last sprint retro we had, one of my items of like, we should stop doing this because it's like start, stop, continue kind of a thing.
Got it.
I was like, we should name our variables more intentionally in our capybara tests, because like sometimes when you have to like simulate an interaction that involves a buyer agent, a showing agent, a user, an admin, a property, a second property, it's like if we name our variables like for users u1, u2, u3, u4, p1, p2, p3, it's like it takes like that much longer to grok through that versus like if it was like sold property and buyer agent and things like that. It just makes it like that much easier and like more self-documenting. So like if you write good tests with good variable names, I think most of the time you won't need documentation.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think too, even Open Listings is a smaller team comparatively to other software teams. And I think there's a certain scale that there's a lot of value in documentation. But I think with smaller teams, there's kind of diminishing returns after a really well-written README and well-written code, which leads us really well into tip 68. You want to take us there, JP? Take us there.
Yeah, I mean, I already touched on some of this, so that's nice. A nice little segue.
Yeah, I know we have. Yeah, it is a good segue.
Build documentation in, don't bolt it on. And so it says, documentation created separately from code is less likely to be correct and up to date. It's funny, my notes here even say, like, name your variables well. one thing I wanted to bring up was that, like, sometimes when an issue comes through from support and we have to, like, fix a bug that seems, like, kind of non-standard, or it's like we're adding some quirky behavior that wouldn't be that obvious, we'll even write, like, the GitHub issue number. So we'll, like, as a comment, it'll be, like, you know, a hash symbol, an octothorpe if you're in Ruby Lamb, and it would be like GH, you know, slash whatever the issue number is, and then like a little explanation like this fixes this. And sometimes you need that. But like, and that's like, you know, part of like the process of coding and part of the process of like writing a test. And, you know, it's just like you're documenting as you go and it's not an afterthought.
Yeah. Yeah. Build documentation in, don't bolt it on. I think that in a more modern language, especially something like Ruby, the documentation is built in by writing really elegant code and really breaking it down. And I was watching, DHH has this awesome series on YouTube. He's the creator of Ruby on Rails, if you don't know. I worship in the church of David Hinemeyer Hansen for sure. So that's DHH. Anyway, he has this YouTube channel that's called Getting Real, and he basically just goes into their product Basecamp, which is all built in Rails, and he just shows the back end and kind of walks through it and a bunch of different stuff. And I've gotten a lot of great stuff out of it. But in one of the episodes, he explained how he always sees every comment as a code smell, and he works really hard to remove comments by breaking down methods smaller and smaller, or breaking down models smaller and smaller. So if he sees a function or method or a model that's really bloated and it just has all these comments on it, he just breaks it down until it no longer needs explaining. And I love that approach. I love the approach that instead of trying to explain something, you simplify it. Instead of trying to, you know, walk someone through how this big case statement works, just extract it out, make it even simpler so that someone just can follow it all the way up from the bottom, all the way up without needing any explanation once you understand the domain. And I think that that, in a way, is building documentation in. I think the other thing that it's saying in the tip is, you know, have your documentation autogen somehow is really what he's getting at here. So it's not a separate team that has to go through and try to document shit after you've written it. It's just right there and it's built in, which I think is a great tip, but I think it's easier said than done, at least the autogen side of things.
Yeah. Also, like the point of like not bolting your documentation on afterwards, it's the same with tests. Like, don't bolt your tests on afterwards, because it's like so much harder to just, you know, bolt it on after the fact, because then you get like really discouraged. Things become out of date very quickly. It's like not easy when you have like very little. So like if you grow with it, it's a lot easier to, you know, not have these broken windows.
Yeah. It's hard though to know at what point you start documenting, because for me, it really oftentimes is at the very end, you know, and I will look at my tests and I'll see what isn't documented in the current. And it's really hard too, like when a model or a method gets renamed or some columns get removed or renamed, it's really hard to remember to know to remember to go back to the README and update that. And yeah, they do fall out of sync. It's really easy to have it happen. And so I think the more that you can have it integrated with the code base in a tight way, the better off you are for sure.
Totally.
Tip 69, gently exceed your user's expectations. So this is the quote from the book, quote, come to understand your user's expectations and then deliver just a little bit more. I love this tip. And it's one of my favorite parts of development is having a client, we negotiate the contract. And then when I finally ship it, just shipping just a little bit more than that contract and just having that delight, especially when users really, really love a feature. I remember like I was doing this health coaching platform and there's this group discussions concept. And there's this discussion forum that you have in this group discussions, and all of the users, they would hack in, kind of like in the early days of Twitter, they would just do an at symbol, even though there was no support in the platform and it wouldn't notify the other party because there was just like posts and then comments on posts. And so people would always like talk back and forth, hacking together with these at symbols, you know, at JP, at John. And so like the phase one was I allowed like you to just click a reply on a comment. So like the concept of comment replies. And like everybody went nuts. They absolutely loved it. And we watched that use of that feature in the application just absolutely soar in the coming months after that. And so it was just like such a win with users, and it wasn't that hard to do. And it was outside of the original scope with my client, but I just kind of did it and shipped it anyway because I knew users would love it. And they were doing it. And so oftentimes this stuff I find is like when you exceed users' expectations, it's sometimes the stuff that people are like already hacking your system to do. Like I remember the days of Twitter that hashtags weren't linkable and you had to like search for them in. And then finally like someone just made it a link. And like that was like awesome. It was just one little thing that we were already doing that just really exceeded expectations.
Yeah, totally. And this tip really reminds me that like, what are we all really doing this for? It's, you know, for, you know, to solve business problems and for our users. It's really cool. Yeah. I was talking to Alex, you know, we have like weekly one-on-ones, And he was telling me how he basically got like a review from someone who was using our app. And they were like, you know, I was choosing between you and one of your competitors who will not be named, but they were basically like, oh, I chose you guys because like the design of your app is just like so good and is like really well designed and like much more easy to use. And that was just like a reminder to me that like, you know, those things matter. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to get like lost in the weeds of things when you're trying to ship a feature and you get your design QA back and you're like, you know, why does this matter? But like it really does because, you know, users do care about those things. Now, obviously, they are going to praise you when like it's like nice and easy to use, but they're not going to say things like, oh, that's really great design. To them, it's just like, oh, this was like a really good experience. I can't like really quite pin why it's a good experience, but I know that it feels much more seamless and easy. Whereas if you have like bad design, that's when they really hammer on you and they're like, this design is terrible. It sucks. Things are so hard to use. How come I can't do this? So it's one of those things where it's like, if you're doing your job well, like no one notices.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that goes, yeah, back to the adage of good design is completely invisible because it's so functional and usable. Like it doesn't even cross your mind how easy the experience just was. Because if design is noticeable in a lot of ways, like it's automatically getting in the way.
Yeah.
So the best design is just totally transparent to users. But I think it's really important to remember there's a user on the other end of software build and try to exceed those users' expectations and really taking pride in what we're doing. Because like the things you build every day, JP, it helps people, families find homes. And like that's a really cool thing. And same with like other stuff that I've built. Like it really helps people ace their midterm that they're super stressed on, the tutoring app and this health coaching app. People are actually reversing their type 2 diabetes through this program. And it's enabled by this application. It's like it's easy to forget that when you're just like have tests failing and there's performance issues and you know you just can't get this CSS Z index to work correctly. Like there's all these different things that we can really get hung up on and forget kind of what made us fall in love with it initially, at least for me, because there's a certain amount of magic to it that's incredible. Like you write this couple lines of code and then you're just like making shit happen in the world. Like I remember the day that I wrote a one-line method in Ruby that sent a Twilio tweet like SMS and it beeped my phone with an SMS message like from the console. I was like, whoa, shit, this is cool. This is like 6 years ago now. But it's like scaling that up now to seeing like real people all over LA, like getting together in Starbucks and other places to have tutoring sessions and see real people losing weight and reversing diabetes. It's super exciting. So I guess like to me, this tip really comes back to remember those users on the other end and really try to exceed their expectations.
Totally. Yeah. Remember that users are on the other end. That's like, I think those are like good words to live by because oftentimes I don't know, maybe I'll speak for myself here, but sometimes I'm like, God, users are so stupid. Like they don't know how to use it. Like they're just doing it wrong. And you have to remember like, you know, they're the ones that you're like building software for, not otherwise like, you know, I wouldn't have a job, but yeah. Taking pride in what you do leads us very nicely into the final tip of this book, which is sign your work. And so the quote from the book is, craftspeople of an earlier age were proud to sign their work. You should be too. And I'm going to read this other really long quote because I think it's a nice send off to the book because I feel like this quote speaks for itself. You know, sign your work, be proud of the work that you do. Those who are anonymous, especially on large projects, can provide a breeding ground for sloppiness, mistakes, sloth, and bad code. We want to see pride of ownership. Your signature should come to be recognized as an indicator of quality, a really professional job written by a real programmer. A pragmatic programmer.
I think it's an awesome quote and a good tip overall. And it really encompasses the book, which is just care about what you do, really take pride in it, sign your work. And that closes out the book. That's all the tips. You want to kind of list off what was in this chapter?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so starting from 65, test state coverage, not code coverage. 66, find bugs once. 67, English is just a programming language. 68, build documentation in, don't bolt it on. 69, gently exceed your users' expectations. And 70, the final tip, sign your work.
Absolutely. I'm actually excited for next week. The plan is to kind of do a book recap of kind of our favorite tips from the book, but in the context of kind of our day-to-day life of programmers. So kind of share a couple wins and losses over the last couple months for me and JP, kind of like in the context of these tips and kind of pulling the best things out of the book. So I'm really excited to do that next week before we kind of go into our next book. And we should be able to announce our next book next week, actually.
Yes, we'll do. Should we get into our final picks for this book?
Yeah, let's do it. You jump in first.
Okay, so my pick is this like really cool Google Chrome extension for GitHub. It's called Refined GitHub. And what it does is it like adds a bunch of JavaScript-y things to GitHub to make GitHub's experience really nice. And so this is like a lot more useful than GitHub's current like implementation of things. When it comes to things like viewing big pull requests, sometimes like you're scrolling in a file and you're looking at a diff and you don't know what file you're in. So for example, adding this plugin will make it so that like the file name is like stickied to the top. So you'll always know. That's like a small little win. Things like showing the names of, you know, people who left emojis on comments or like the reactions. It's not like, you know, make or break, but it's like still a pretty cool thing. And obviously that's just like two of like the very many things that are added on. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I like too that like he scratched his own itch and he's just like, well, fuck it. I'm just going to build this stuff. Like we were talking about this one of the other episodes. It's like, we're developers. Just build it if you feel like it could be better. And I like too that he says like right in the readme, like if you like these features, like email GitHub, say to copy me. Like he's very open about this. And it's really cool. It's such an interesting project. It's really interesting. Good pick, man.
Cool. What's yours?
My pick this week is actually a monitor. I've been loving this thing and they're actually pretty cheap on Amazon right now. We don't do affiliate links or anything, but if you feel like you've been looking for a really good monitor, this is the one kind of specifically built for Macs. It's this USB-C LG Ultrafine 4K display, which direct from Apple right now is like $700 or $800 for like a 22-inch monitor, which is crazy. But on Amazon right now, it's like $350, and I have loved this thing. I've had it about 3 weeks now. I didn't know the difference having a 4K monitor on my desk would make versus like a standard low-resolution monitor, and I have just like gotten so much out of it. It's been really, really kick-ass. So it's just kind of a random pick that's really, really worked out super well for me.
Dang, that is pretty sweet. That is not a bad price. Yeah, 4K like changed the game up for me.
Oh, totally. And like, I feel like once you see those retina displays, like anything else just burns your eyes. Like right now I have four windows on my screen. It's only a 22-inch monitor and everything's very readable. Like that's incredible. It's just the resolution is there that it's super readable. All right. Well, that wraps up The Pragmatic Programmer. Next week, we'll be doing a book recap. We're looking forward to having you back for that. And until next time, you know, keep building the future. We'll see you guys next time.
Sweet. Hope you guys enjoyed it. We'll talk to you guys next week.